All right, you are back with the Mark Moss Show, where each week I bring to you the latest information on Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, and the decentralized revolution. As I've been talking about, it's probably the biggest opportunity that you'll ever see in your lifetime. It's literally changing the way humanity works. It is that big. Now, I am joined with my good friend Alex Gladstein with the Human Rights Foundation. And the reason why I wanted to have him in today is to establish the foundation of what I think really the importance of Bitcoin is. And I know that a lot of people are chasing cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin to try to get rich, and they're trying to increase their US dollar supply, the value of those US dollars, or whatever they're trying to do there. And of course, we all want to make money, and that's great. We want that opportunity, but really it's so much more. Bitcoin is fixing the world. We say fix the money, fix the world. And Alex is really at the forefront of that. And so, Alex, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with me today. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
Yeah. So you wrote a paper recently talking about how, you know, the Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency revolution. And there was a piece in there specifically that I looked at. And you quoted a piece from Greg Barker that he had written, and it was a criticism of Bitcoin, saying, rather than producing a more open, more liberating, more financially free society, the crypto movement has empowered not just another cabal of corrupt financiers, but a hidden cartel of criminals, Wall Street rejects, and what Senator Elizabeth Warren has described as shadowy super coders. And so I guess that's the criticism about Bitcoin. And I think maybe that quote there kind of summarizes what your response was in that paper. So give us your response to that. I mean, that's a kind of a damning criticism of Bitcoin, right?
Look, I used Greg's piece and I quoted from it in my writing because I thought it was a good summary of existing criticism of Bitcoin and of cryptocurrencies, or let's call it crypto, as the cool kids say. And my point is that his criticism is accurate of crypto or of cryptocurrencies. It's true. They all are insider projects where people decided to make money, you know, with the click of a button, and they got their friends rich, and they still control everything. And the state has influence and can shut people down. And it's really just like, you know, an unregulated extension of Wall Street or Las Vegas. And it's not revolutionary in my view. What's revolutionary is Bitcoin. And I think that's what I want to get across in this interview to folks, is from a human rights perspective, not from a financial perspective, where obviously you made a lot more money in Dogecoin in the last 12 months than in Bitcoin. Right. But over time, the fact that Bitcoin is changing the world, whereas crypto is like an extension of the existing system. Yeah. And the difference is that in Bitcoin, it is powered by users, and there is no central point of failure. And there was no one who can control the monetary policy, who can decide to print more Bitcoin, who can, you know, arbitrarily change the Bitcoin software without your consent, or who can even process transactions without your consent. Right. In Bitcoin, if you run a personal server and you're running a node and you're part of the network as a full Bitcoin citizen, let's say, as many, many thousands of people across the world are, you decide what transactions are valid. You know, you have control over the miners, and you decide what software updates to accept. So you have control over the developers. And in this way, Bitcoin is truly like money of the people. And I view like the other cryptocurrency projects, regardless of their utility, as more like fintech, or, you know, perhaps more unregulated stocks or tech startups. Like they may deliver enormous value, but they don't kind of reshape the paradigm. And I think that's quite important for people to understand, because Bitcoin is unregulatable and decentralized, it can help people in the toughest of environments. It can help people inside China and inside dictatorships. Whereas crypto can get censored and blacklisted and pressured. And in the end, over the coming century, as we battle like digital authoritarianism and as we battle Big Brother, Bitcoin is a tool to fight back, where I just don't think crypto is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. You're listening to the Mark Moss Show on the iHeartRadio Network. I'm with Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. You can find him on Twitter at at Gladstein. So send him a tweet, follow him. But we're talking about using it as a human rights tool. And I know, you know, pretty much everyone listening probably right now is in the United States, and they don't feel that, right? They don't feel that authoritism. You just mentioned China, right? And so, it's over there in China, or it's happening in Lebanon or whatever, but maybe it's not in the United States. But one, if it's happening there, it could potentially come here. But two, we saw, and you probably know better than me, a month ago, where even PayPal teamed up with the Anti-Defamation League to like make a list of people that should be blacklisted from being able to send payments to each other, right? Literally censoring the ability to send money to who I want, and then sharing that list with even more financial institutions.
Yeah. So let's take a philosophical view and then a global view. So philosophically, when we talk about money, what is money? We're in a transition where the money that you use on a daily basis is going from a bearer asset that protects your privacy to one of surveillance and control. So like the money that you used maybe 10, 20 years ago was paper money, cash. When you make a cash transaction, the merchant doesn't know anything about you. They just know that you've paid. Right. When you pay with your credit card or your swipe or your phone or your mobile money or whatever, you know, the merchant and an enormous number of third parties and ultimately the government knows a ton about you. They know exactly what you bought. They know what you bought last time. They can build algorithms to figure out what you're going to buy next. And this can be used for censorship and surveillance and social engineering. And it is being used for that, not just in China, but all over the world, including right here in the United States. I mean, when you go into markets, I mean, they're like Bluetooth, like surveillance mechanisms that pick up on your shopping habits. And, you know, they can read this off your phone and your transaction history. And this is a direction we're heading in, and we need a different way to preserve our digital freedoms in the future, because the government's not going to give them to us.
Right.
If you think that the government is going to phase out paper cash, which children today won't use regardless. Like, we know that children today, when they're 20 years old, won't use paper money. Right. Everything's going to be digital. So the question is, how are we going to keep the freedoms and privacy that cash afforded us in the digital space? There's two camps. One says the government's going to give it to us. Okay. I mean, did you see the Snowden revelations? Like, I don't know like what planet you're living on, but there's a lot of people who believe that like we can like petition the US government and we can like get them to give us digital cash and we could be free. I'm just jaded on that one as a human rights activist. Like, I just don't think that's going to happen. And maybe in the tiniest of scenarios in the US or Switzerland or Japan, but definitely not in China or Saudi Arabia or Cuba. Like, you know, 4.3 billion people live under dictatorships and authoritarian regimes. They're never going to get, you know, fiat government money that protects freedoms in the future. And this is why Bitcoin's so important, is it gives us this like plan B that anybody can access without any particular nationality or wealth level or gender or belief system. Like, anyone can access this open, non-discriminatory network and both use it as digital cash and make payments seamlessly, instantly around the world through the Lightning Network, which is remarkable, but also invest their time and energy in digital gold in an asset that cannot be debased by a government. And Bitcoin is the only digital asset that cannot be arbitrarily debased. Every single other cryptocurrency and every single other central bank digital currency or just general digital currency, like your deposit at the bank, can be confiscated, can be debased by monetary policy. And that's what makes Bitcoin so special.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, how cash gives us that privacy, that anonymity there. And in 1970, when they put the Bank Secrecy Act in, they said all transactions over $10,000 had to be reported. But at the time, $10,000 in 1970 is worth about $70,000 today. But they've kept that number at 10,000. But now today, they are saying now, per this new infrastructure bill, they want to now monitor every single bank account with more than $600, every single transaction, including Venmo, crypto, PayPal, et cetera. I want to talk more about human rights stuff around the world and even real world use cases of how that's being fixed when we get back in a second. But everyone, you're listening to the Mark Moss Show with Alex Gladstein talking about Bitcoin and human rights, and we'll be right back. All right, you are back with the Mark Moss Show talking about Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, the decentralized revolutions, and I'm with Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. You can find him on Twitter at Gladstein. He's definitely worth a follow, so go check him out there. And we are in the middle of talking about how Bitcoin has a real-world use case, how it's solving human rights issues. We talked about, you know, having the freedom and the privacy of using digital cash. But Alex, I really wanted to jump into maybe some maybe more practical applications. I know you've published many times on Twitter where people say that Bitcoin has no use case. And these people that say this, I feel like how much privilege you have being in the United States. You must have never traveled anywhere else in the world. But maybe you could give us some practical applications of things that are going on in the world where it's really making a big impact.
Yeah, I wrote a piece called Check Your Financial Privilege for Bitcoin Magazine about 6 months ago. And, you know, that's summing it up in a nutshell. Like Bitcoin critics today who say that it's useless are hugely financial privileged. They were born into a system where the unit of account is the dollar, where they don't have to deal with significant inflation, at least yet, where they can easily use stuff like Venmo and PayPal to connect with their family and friends. It's easy for them to travel abroad. Like their money basically works. They can invest long-term very easily in a 401k or maybe even into real estate. Easy for them to get stocks, et cetera, even bonds. They can build like a diversified portfolio for their future. The vast majority of humans on this planet cannot do that. 1.3 billion people on our planet live under double or triple or quadruple digit inflation. So that means the money that they earn every week or every 2 weeks, every month, is literally disappearing before their eyes. Most of these people do not have access to the S&P 500. They do not have enough capital to buy a home. Like,
real quick on that. I mean, give us some examples. So like Lebanon, I think saw like almost 80 or 90% inflation in the last year. So that means like literally like they lost the majority of their purchasing power like that quickly.
Yeah. So I'll give you a couple examples from each part of the world. Of that 1.3 billion people who live under severe extreme inflation. And by the way, that number is more than the number of people who don't have access to a toilet or clean water. Like this is one of the biggest humanitarian issues in the world. You mentioned Lebanon. Yeah. Lebanon and Syria, both home to millions of people, are seeing a historic currency collapse. Lebanon in particular now, I believe, has the highest rate of inflation in the world, surpassing Venezuela, which had its own absolutely catastrophic hyperinflation over the last decade, where, you know, a cup of coffee in Caracas, you know, would cost, you know, a few hundred bolivars, and then the next year would cost a few thousand, and the next year would cost a few million. Like that actually happened. You have 50% inflation in Argentina. You have it's a country of 45 million people. You have 15% inflation in Nigeria and higher food inflation, country of 200 million people. You have 15% inflation in Turkey, another country with close to 100 million people. You have a country of 120 million people in Ethiopia, where you have inflation of 20%. So these are vast, very large, very important countries where
I just want to add one thing. Sorry, because in the United States, the Federal Reserve printed about 25% of the dollar supply in the last year. And of course, we saw prices go up by about 25%. So in the US, the median home price went up by 24%. Used cars are up 30%. Gasoline is up 47%. And so it's not just those faraway countries, it's in the United States as well. So go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So, but think about it this way. Yes, you're correct. There is currency debasement and inflation in the United States. It's not usually quite as noticeable for a variety of reasons that I won't get into here. But what you just need to know is that the dollar is like the foundation for the world's fiat currencies. And any bad effects you see in the dollar get amplified elsewhere. So, you know, price inflation in the United States, if we're seeing it, oh my God, that means things are like catastrophic for people in the countries I just mentioned, right? So all around the world, Burma in Southeast Asia just saw a massive loss of purchasing power in the citizens over the last few months. They lost 60, 70, 80% of their purchasing power. Cuba, an island country just off the coast of Florida, very close to us, very close to maybe a lot of the hearts of our listeners. The Cuban people have lost 2/3 of their purchasing power in the last year, as the government has basically failed to run properly and is running a scheme where they're paying the pensioners. It's a communist nation, right? So most workers are public sector workers and pensioners. They're paying out pesos, which are collapsing. And then they have all these stores where you can buy what you need, and they're forcing you to use hard foreign currency to buy stuff in those stores. Mm-hmm. So it's like they're turning this crap money into better money at the expense of the people. And this is a game that a lot of governments play around the world, right? So whether it's in Cuba, whether it's in Palestine, whether it's in Nigeria, Ethiopia, yes, I've been like studying and interviewing people in these countries and just trying to learn about like how the government exploits money, how it uses it as a weapon against the people, and how people are turning to Bitcoin to fight back.
Yeah. So, you know, the government in that scheme, I mean, that's crazy. So they're literally paying them in a currency that's losing value, but making them pay them back in a currency that's stronger. Mm-hmm. And it's all over the world. In the previous segment, when I had Alex Fetsky and Jessica on, we were talking about the China banned Bitcoin again.
Sure.
Again, and I think the ninth time or whatever. And they said it put at risk the financial and social system. And so kind of what they're saying is that they need to manipulate their currency, but by allowing people an exit, that disrupts the system. So it's all over the place. I mean, that's a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, there's millions of Bitcoin users in China. There's more than 10 million in India. There's millions in Turkey. There's millions in Nigeria. There's millions in Argentina. I mean, anyone on Wall Street or in the New York Times who says that it's some sort of cosplay or some sort of, you know, online libertarian nonsense is just ignorant. I mean, right. And I almost feel bad for them and how wrong they are. Like the literally the most prestigious newspapers and talk show hosts in our country are completely clueless about one of the most important revolutions in history. I mean, we're separating money from state. I mean, this is on par with the printing press and democracy in ancient Greece. I mean, we're living through a similarly important time right now, and they're just completely out to lunch. And the cool part is, regardless of what they say, these professional Bitcoin critics, regardless of how they've tried to gaslight you, the American people over the last 10 years, saying Bitcoin's too dangerous, it's too risky. Regardless of what they say, Bitcoin is right now, as we speak, empowering tens of millions of people around the world who don't have a better money. And it's doing more for people, for empowerment and for justice and for freedom than any of those critics will ever do in their entire lifetime. It's doing in the next 60 minutes. So, I mean, Bitcoin is saying basically, screw you all. And the crazy part is that this is a gaslighting operation. Like over the last decade, Americans and Brits and Chileans and Chinese, we've been told by our governments that Bitcoin is, first of all, they said it was a joke. Then they said it was risky. Now, then they said it was dangerous. Okay. Guess what's been dangerous? Not buying Bitcoin. Okay. Now let's just look at the dollar. Okay. The dollar has had a hyperinflationary collapse against Bitcoin over the last 10 years. Okay. So they've forced you to stay away from that. They've convinced you that it's a bad idea. And you've ended up losing purchasing power, you know, unless you've been lucky enough to really like do well with, you know, equities and real estate. But like most people don't, right? Most people just are just getting by, and the money they're using to just get by has been depreciating in purchasing power, and they have more debt than ever. So, I mean, I think it just depends on your perspective. But what's been crazy to me is to watch like the academic, political, media elite continue to say this thing is dangerous when it is saving so many people around the world.
Yeah. I love what you said there. They're gaslighting, or really they're these professional critics, as you say, they're telling you stuff that's holding you back, which is why I want to bring this information to you. You're listening to The Mark Maugh Show. I'm with Alex Gladstein, and we'll be right back. All right. Welcome back. You're with The Mark Maugh Show on the iHeartRadio Network. Each week, I'm bringing you the information you need to navigate the Bitcoin cryptocurrency decentralized revolution. And make no mistake, it is a revolution that will fix the world. Fix the money, fix the world. I'm with Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. He is a big proponent of Bitcoin around the world. You can follow him on Twitter at Gladstein, and you definitely should give him a follow. But we were right in the middle of this one of his rants. I had to cut him off, and why don't you jump back in?
Yeah, no, I just look again, like professional economists and policymakers in the United States are bending over backwards to convince themselves that currency debasement and basically printing more money to solve our nation's problems is going to be good. And at the same time, they're attacking Bitcoin, which is like the plan B that citizens can use to defend themselves, right? So what you got to know is that these people are self-interested in the existing system. You should protect yourself with Bitcoin. You should first learn about it, arm yourself with education and knowledge and learn about Bitcoin. And then over time, obviously try to start earning it, you know, converting some of your fiat money into it, et cetera, et cetera. That fiat money is going to lose value over time, is going to lose a tremendous amount of value over the next decade. Yeah. If you're listening from Ethiopia or Sudan, it's going to lose money a lot faster and value a lot faster. But still, I mean, even the United States or EU, that money is going to lose a lot of value. People are going to seek to move elsewhere. And the interesting thing is we have this big debate now about minting the coin, like the United States has a budget issue. We're going to run out of money. And some people say, oh, the Treasury should just mint $1 trillion you know, platinum coin and sell it to the Fed, right? As like a way to fix it. Well, what's cooler than $1 trillion platinum coin? $1 trillion freedom money, which is, you know, Bitcoin is, you know, around $900 billion, and, or, you know, had previously topped $1 trillion early this year, and we'll top it again soon. So this freedom money, this $1 trillion freedom money is open to everybody on earth. You know, if here's the interesting part. If the US government tries to save corporations and the financial sector and the stocks that all of our senators and congressmen own by minting the coin, okay, that doesn't help everybody on earth, right? That only helps some people. Bitcoin is like this level open playing field that's literally open for business for anyone with an internet connection anywhere in the world. And you know, that's why you might say the capital of Bitcoin is not New York or Washington, but probably Lagos, Nigeria. You know, this like a place, a country of 200 million people where, you know, just a massive and growing number of millions of young Nigerians are turning to Bitcoin, not just as a place to store their wealth over time, but as a place to connect with the world. And that's what I want to talk about now a little bit, is like Bitcoin as a sort of digital cash, as a bridge between people, as something that can connect us in a world that has way too many walls, right? So again, anyone with internet, whether you're in China or Iran or wherever, you can access this thing, and there's no gate or barrier to prevent you from doing so. So I've interacted with all kinds of Bitcoin users in the countries I just mentioned. I mean, in Gaza, in Cuba, in places that I'm usually not allowed to have connection with, like I can transact Bitcoin with these people. It's this really beautiful thing that brings us together. And what makes it possible is the Lightning Network. Like, and look, I know a lot of critics, especially in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, that are always trashing Bitcoin for being slow and expensive.
Right.
Okay. Yes. On-chain Bitcoin over time is going to be slow and expensive compared to Visa. Yes. It's going to take 10, 20 minutes to settle. And the fees right now, they're cheap. They're like 50 cents. But like, I think fees will be considerable on chain in the future, $20, $30, maybe more. Okay. Maybe a lot more. However, what people did is they figured out how to scale Bitcoin using a second layer called the Lightning Network. And with Lightning Network, you can send Bitcoin instantly and basically for free anywhere on earth. And it's a little more privacy protecting even than Bitcoin, because it's not happening on the chain. So you can't have chain surveillance messing your stuff up, right? So the cool part about Lightning is it's really getting adopted massively around the world. So Twitter, the actual platform Twitter, has now partnered up with a company called Strike to allow creators to accept Lightning donations. So I just turned it on.
I keep getting them.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. I just turned it on a couple of days ago. I connected my Strike account, and I've been receiving Lightning tips from God knows who all over the world. Like they come in all the time. People who are happy about my articles or whatever. And it's just so beautiful. It's so cool to be connected to the community in that way. And it's nice to see Twitter connecting itself to an open monetary network. And that's what Bitcoin is. Now there's a country that just did it too, in El Salvador, like this small, relatively impoverished Central American country decided to add Bitcoin as a legal tender about a month ago. And this is revolutionary for many reasons. I mean, you could see it in the same historical lenses. You know, the Brits invented central banking 500 plus years ago. Okay, well, El Salvador is the first country to add an open decentralized currency for the population. Now, the rollout is hotly contested. The leader doing it is authoritarian, in my view. And we need to be careful to separate the act of choosing Bitcoin for the people, as opposed to some China currency or some CBDC or some surveillance coin, right?
Yes.
They chose Bitcoin, which is amazing. We need to separate that from like cheering for that government, which is a dangerous government, I would say. So these are going to be nuanced things. And you listening are about to live through a decade where dozens of other governments adopt Bitcoin. And they're not all going to be ones you like, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I thought it was going to be like a rogue regime that would use this thing first, right? It's sort of similar to the idea of the beginning of the internet. Like when the internet first came out, there was a lot of criticism. Oh, it's going to like empower sketchy people. Like, yes.
Well, in the beginning, it was used for porn. Like that was its main use case. And actually when the VCR came out, the VCR was only used for porn before Disney used it. And then the internet was only used for porn. And so usually technology seems to have like some sort of nefarious use case before it gets.
Yeah. There's always edge users at the beginning. Like even when Bitcoin was first invented, like, you know, the Silk Road was one of its major first use cases. Right. Okay. But we're way beyond that now. Like now we're at like governments adopting Bitcoin. Right. So like we're so far, much further along in Bitcoin's history than at that point. And you know, governments of all shapes and sizes, corporations of all shapes and sizes are going to be forced to use it, not out of any altruistic reason, but simply because it's the best money. Okay. Yeah. And it's the best way for them to preserve their purchasing power over time. Mm-hmm. That is what is going to force them to use it. They're not going to have to think about it much more than that. Right. And the cool part is that whether they like it or not, these corporations, these governments, whether it's Tesla, whether it's Square, whether it's Paul Tudor Jones or other billionaires, whether it's governments like El Salvador, whether they like it or not, when they adopt Bitcoin, they help strengthen this like global freedom right. tool. And that's like this fascinating mechanism at work here.
Yeah. Everyone's a freedom fighter, whether they realize it or not. The one thing that I just think about, and I know both of us have been down to El Salvador, and you've been at the forefront of this, definitely more than me, but I've traveled quite a bit. I'm a surfer, so I travel to these very remote locations to chase remote waves. So I've witnessed this, and I think more people, especially in the United States, should travel to get that perspective. But even though I knew what was going on down there, it wasn't until I actually put boots on the ground that it really was like this epiphany where you actually see it. And you realize, you know, specifically there, it's like kind of solving this remittance problem, where instead of having to ride a bus for 2 hours to San Salvador to get my money and then ride 2 hours back and then potentially get robbed with cash and then losing whatever 20, 30% to fees, now I can just get it instantly. And when you have something that's not just a 5 or 10% incremental improvement, but 100x or 1,000x improvement like this is, I mean, it just can't be stopped. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about, I love the fact that you said we need to kind of separate the politics of what may be happening in El Salvador versus Bitcoin, the tool. And I think it's important to look at that. So I want to talk more about that. And then when I get back, I want to also talk about some questions I had posed from the audience that I want to ask you as well. So we'll get into more of that as well. I'm with Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. Follow him on Twitter at Gladstein. Of course, I'm Mark Moss. This is the Mark Moss Show. You can follow me, number one, Mark Moss. And we're talking about Bitcoin being used as a human rights tool, which I think is so important. And so we'll be right back. All right. You are back with the Mark Moss Show, talking about Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, the decentralized revolutions. And I'm with Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. Follow him on Twitter at Gladstein and look up the Human Rights Foundation online and find out what they're doing. But we were right in the middle of talking about, you know, how Bitcoin can solve all these human rights issues. And we were specifically talking about El Salvador. One thing, you know, we've seen a lot of news about the politics down there. And is the president a dictator? Is he going to try to change it so he can stay in power? Is he using Bitcoin to steal from the people and all these things? I don't know enough about the politics, but I think you made a great point, which is we need to separate, you know, Bitcoin being a tool that could be used by anybody and then what the politics are. But one other point I'd like to just get your opinion on, I know, like I said, we've both been down there and witnessed this in real time, is, and I think maybe you've kind of said you weren't a big fan of it, but he basically forced in a law of making Bitcoin legal tender. And so per the law, everyone, you know, I guess as a merchant is required to accept it because it's legal tender. And so they have to allow someone to pay that way. It seems like from the way I understand the law, they have to allow someone to pay that way, but they don't have to receive the Bitcoin or hold Bitcoin. And so I know some people have kind of been outspoken where, well, Bitcoin should be free to adopt. It shouldn't be forced onto people. Where do you think, how do you see that?
Yeah. I mean, like personally, I wish they hadn't made it, you know, enforced in that way. I think it should be voluntary. However, as a Bitcoin user and someone who thinks it will become more popular in the future, I knew this day was coming. Like I knew one day a government would do this, like at some point. I just didn't think it would happen in 2021. I thought right. this was like way far into the future. but the governor of El Salvador has like self-interest in trying to like basically boost its nation into the future by like making them a Bitcoin economy. Like it feels that it can gain fame, which it already has. I mean, Bukele is like easily the most famous Central American leader now, and no one knew who he was like a year ago. it feels like it can gain foreign investment, which it's gaining for sure. It yep. feels like it can gain notoriety, like basically publicity, which I mean, El Salvador had never been on the cover or as a feature in any financial yep. magazine ever. I mean, the only thing that this country led the world in as of 4 or 5 years ago was murder rate. Okay.
Yep.
And all of a sudden now, like people are debating, you know, it's like fintech innovation, which is yeah. really remarkable. And a lot of Salvadorans are happy about that. You know, some aren't, but a lot are. So I think it's interesting how, you know, we can argue about the legal tender part. But at the end of the day, like, I mean, I think every citizen in the world should have the ability to have Bitcoin as legal tender in their country. Now, is that going to happen? No way. There's no way that governments right now will do that. However, I think some governments will start to, and it's the beginning of a trend. And, you know, some governments will simply adopt Bitcoin as a reserve asset for their national savings. Others will do more, like El Salvador is doing. Others will try and incorporate it for remittances. Like, there's every reason for countries like Tonga, which are 40% of the GDP is reliant on remittances, or countries like El Salvador, which are 23, 24% reliant on remittances, or even countries like Nigeria, which are even like around 5%, you know, reliant on remittances. If your gross domestic product, if your revenue as a nation is significantly derived from remittances, then you have every reason to want to shift to a Lightning Network based system where these corporations and these middlemen don't suck value out of your citizenry and therefore out of your tax base, right?
Right.
Like, you're self-interested to attach yourself to this open monetary system. And when you think about what's happening now, Salvadorans in the United States, there's 2 million plus Salvadorans in the United States, right? They can now go, like, you know, there's a video of someone in Atlanta. They can just go to like the embassy if they wanted to, and deposit cash, physical cash, into a Chivo machine in Atlanta, and their family can like receive it immediately and then just like withdraw it into Bitcoin or cash in El Salvador without dealing with remittance companies. Like, that's kind of amazing. The more amazing thing is that any Salvadoran in the United States or anywhere in the world can send a Lightning Network instant payment to anyone with a state-run Chivo wallet or anyone with a non-custodial open source wallet in El Salvador instantly. And the value just goes peer-to-peer and there's no blood-sucking middlemen in the middle, right? So this is like, we are moving forward in terms of financial technology. Like, legacy stuff like Western Union, these are like blockbusters and this is like dinosaur tech. And we are like obliterating it with like this open source wave of technology that's really going to help connect us all again in a world with a lot of bridges and a lot of barriers. I mean, it's to me, it's a quite beautiful thing.
One thing that, you know, you've talked about 4.5 billion people living under authoritarian regimes. And I think it's pretty easy to see that the world is trending towards authoritarianism and technology is giving them more and more tools they need to even, you know, continue to build that authoritarianism. I've often been saying that I think the only thing that breaks that trend of us moving to authoritarianism is really competition. And so when we're able to leave, like a sovereign individual says, like a cow grows wings and flies away, if enough people leave, the nations will be forced to kind of change. And like China did, they were communists, they were trailing the world, they had to open up to a little bit of free ports and capitalism to compete. And we're seeing this play out in real time now with El Salvador, as you were making the case, just by a simple act of making Bitcoin legal tender. Like you said, all of a sudden they're now you know who the president is, they're making news headlines, but even more important, they're attracting massive amounts of capital coming into the country just by one small thing. And I think that that competition loop that we'll see more countries want to jump in. You already named a couple countries that are thinking about it. And I think that could really start to accelerate this trend and eventually, maybe hopefully, force those authoritarian countries that will continue to have this downward decline because of that grip, get them to kind of force or change their perspective. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, look, it's inevitable. Look, this is a people's revolution. It's being led by the people. I mean, there 99% of all Bitcoin users plus are not in El Salvador. Like, there's more Indian Bitcoin users than there are Salvadorans. Okay, so let's not lose sight of the fact that this is a global phenomena where El Salvador has played an important but relatively very small role. This is a individual citizen-led thing where people are peacefully opting out into a new system. And if the thing grows big enough, it's going to snowball and it's going to start, you know, bringing governments with it. One thing that I would be remiss to not mention would be Bitcoin mining. I just think real quick that this is going to have a huge impact on the world. And what's interesting is you're seeing the Salvadoran government now start to use its volcanic energy to mine Bitcoin. Like they're just turning geothermal heat, carbon neutral, kind of green volcanic energy that's just sort of stranded. They're turning that into money through Bitcoin mining, which converts electricity into money. So you're seeing that happen all over the world. So in Virunga Park in the DRC in Central Africa, they're turning flowing water into Bitcoin through hydro dams. You're seeing people turn sunlight into money through solar farms, wind farms, turning air into money. Like this is going to happen all across the emerging markets. And like basically countries are going to start realizing that they can like actually raise money, raise bonds, et cetera, through stranded renewable energy resources. And in my view, it's going to help sort of like green the planet as like we have new incentives to use stranded renewable energy resources. And to me, this is really important because currently like fossil fuel companies have like such a stranglehold over, you know, a lot of the energy market and a lot of our lives. I mean, they undergird the petrodollar, which is what the US dollar really is. And, you know, I think that's bad for human rights. Look, it leads to our relationship with Saudi Arabia and how we back these thugs for decades. Leads to wars, it leads to conflicts. And we have a new option now. Like people can opt into a new currency that's not backed by violence or thugs or warships or the US military or by oil. Like we have a new currency that can be backed entirely by clean energy and can be run by the people themselves. And I just think that's a beautiful vision for the future.
Yeah, it is. And it's going to reshape the world. You know, typically a country would be, typically it was by the natural resources, whether they had gold or oil. And now nations that had no natural resources, but they have energy could have Bitcoin. And this is the Mark Moss Show on the iHeartRadio Network with Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. Check him out at hrf.org. Follow Alex at Gladstein on Twitter. And of course, I am one Mark Moss on Twitter. With that, I got to wrap it up. Thanks for listening to the Mark Moss Show.